October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. As a result, we are re-releasing Cydia's childhood story, Surviving Chaos, Episode 31.
If you've been a victim of domestic violence, you can reach out to 1-800-799-SAFE-7233.
Hello, and welcome to Pivotal Moments, a podcast sharing, exploring, and celebrating stories of change, big or small. We are all agents of change and have the power to pivot at any point, at any time. I'm your host, Melissa Robena, along with my co-host, Cydia Gutierrez. On this episode, we turn the mic on ourselves. I was curious as how Cydia went from scared straight to badass litigator. Content warning, Cydia's story involves domestic violence and self-harm. Listener discretion is advised.
This is
exciting. I'm excited. So
I'm nervous.
So you and I, what is there to be nervous about?
It's still nerve-wracking.
So listeners, today, Cydia and I are each interviewing ourselves. We realize that we bring people on, they share their amazing stories of pivots that they've made. And, you know, it's time that we turn the mic on ourselves. You know, we were going back and forth as to what pivot do we focus on? Because life is just full of pivots. And
we're old.
We're old as shit. So I'm just going to start off with, okay, so Cydia, listeners, you may not know this. She's a badass, like, plaintiff's attorney and has been recognized in the state. She's, like, so, like, overachieving. I want to say she, like, was it top 40 under 40?
I've been recognized for that, yeah.
So in addition to that, she also volunteers and serves on numerous nonprofit organizations. The few that come to mind are the Cupcake Girls, which provides support and resources for those in the sex industry.
Yes, I'm involved, but I'm not on the board anymore.
But you also serve or have served on the Las Vegas Latino Bar Association, and mm-hmm. you helped put together their 5K race, the Andale. Mm-hmm. To help raise money for tuition for those that wish to take the LSAT, right?
Yes, to equalize law school admissions.
You know, just a few things. And then there's Seroptimus, which encourages women empowerment through education, you know, which you did serve on. Are you still VP?
No, not currently. I stepped away. I think I talked about it in a different episode where I had the opportunity to step away from a lot of things and all of these great, wonderful organizations. I just needed a break. Mm-hmm. And the pause of 2020 allowed me to do that.
So, listeners, these are just three of the ones that came to my mind when I was kind of framing this interview. So she's a badass. In episode 10, where we talk about grief and FOMO, Cydia shares how she was on the wrong side of the tracks and was a candidate for the Scared Straight program, which completely blew me away because I did not know that about you. So obviously your life consisted of several pivots that took you from, you know, and I put this in air quotes, you know, going from taking field trips to prison to being the strong, independent woman that I know. Mm-hmm. So I basically want to learn more about these pivots. So I'd like to press the rewind button if we can. So describe what your life was like growing up back then.
Oh, what had me going to the Scared Straight program was there was a lot of chaos in my household. And so what I've come to realize now as an adult is that that chaos was affecting me in just kind of how I valued myself and how I valued life. So pretty early on, I, you know, developed early, so that probably didn't help the process. But I, instead of focusing on, hey, I've got this exam or grades or things like that, and having somebody in my corner telling me to focus on those things, I didn't have that kind of supervision. And so if I was failing a class, I'd be like, that sucks. Like, yeah. So I wasn't really parented is how I feel about the situation. And so they would interject at weird spots, like at the Scared Straight program, like, no, you don't actually need that. But I was smoking cigarettes. I started engaging in sexual activity at a very young age, and was running with a similar crowd who also had problems at home. They were either parents who had divorced, that seemed to be an issue. But it was really starting to experiment more with just drugs and sex, basically. Like, mm-hmm. have you ever seen the movie 13?
No.
No? Okay. That movie, when it came out, Catherine Hardwick was the director and Nikki Reed starred in it. Nikki Reed was later in the Twilight franchise and married Ian Somerhalder. Not that I, you know, like celebrity things or anything, but it was this movie that at the time people were like, wow, I can't believe that this is what 13-year-old girls are doing. They're stealing things. I never got into the stealing aspect. I had friends who were stealing stuff, and it was like stupid shit, like, you know, a thong. Mm-hmm. It's like, are you really going to get in trouble to steal a thong? Piercing their own belly buttons. I pierced my own belly button. Or I tried to. It was not very successful. And other things, like if I had been able to get a tattoo, like I probably would have at that age. I didn't do that until I was later in my 20s. But just having parents who were so self-involved that they weren't paying attention to what was going on with their kids.
So talk a little bit about that. You mentioned that growing up, and I want this to be a safe space for you. And I know mm-hmm. that talking about your childhood can trigger it. And that's not what I want for this interview. So if at any point in time it gets to be too much, please let me know. I heart you. Okay. So you mentioned that you're growing up, your house was chaos. What do you mean by that?
My parents, so let me put it this way. My parents met when they were about 22, 23 years old. And my mom already had two kids and met my dad at the local hospital in Central America where she was working, and pretty quickly got pregnant with me, mm-hmm. is my understanding of it. And so my mom had me at 23 and I was her third child. My dad was from Nicaragua and my mom's from Guatemala. I was born in Guatemala. My dad's family came to the United States because the revolution was going on mm-hmm. in Nicaragua with the Sandinista revolution and everything. So it wasn't safe for him to go back. And he wanted to go back to Nicaragua, but it wasn't safe. And his family basically came to the U.S. And so my mom followed him to the U.S. because he asked her to. She didn't come over here. It's not one of those immigrant stories where, oh, she came over here because she wanted a better life for her kids. Like, those things may have been in there, but really she came here for love. Mm-hmm. She was in love with my dad. She wanted to be a family. My dad wanted her to come, didn't want me to be raised without him, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So she came over here, and like that was a huge leap for her to do, especially because they didn't know each other. They'd never lived with each other. I think even in the first couple months of my life, like my first month of life, my mom was hospitalized. It was a very bad surgery, C-section. It was a very bad C-section. She got a huge infection. And so my dad raised me for that first month. And so my parents didn't have that time to get to know each other. They came here in a new country with no friends, no family support. And my mom really not knowing my dad. And my dad, he grew up in a very traumatic household where there was a lot of alcohol abuse and a lot of domestic violence. And I think it was both ways. I think my grandmother definitely attacked my grandfather a couple times that he saw. And so my dad started self-medicating as a teenager with smoking weed, which now it's legalized everywhere. Like, it's cool.
But back then, though,
back then it was a big, deal.
Yeah.
And so my dad brought that with him to the United States. And he, even though he's been trained as a surgeon, my dad's a surgeon in Central America, he never really wanted that career. He never wanted to exercise that. And so when he came to the States, he tried to get into the medical field, but I don't know how hard he tried. I was too young to be around for this, but I have seen the documentation and I know that he tried a couple times and was not able to pass mostly the English portion, not necessarily the technical portion of the exam. And so my mom came thinking she was going to be with, you know, her doctor, and neither of them knowing each other. And mm-hmm. so that was really, I think, the heart of the problem. They had to get to know each other and grow up together in their early 20s in a new country. There was just a lot of chaos there. You know, I think one of the first times my dad hit my mom was because she didn't know how to cook. Hmm. So she burnt the rice. She had to learn how to cook here because she didn't know how to do any of that stuff. She was pretty well off in Central America, was like the equivalent of the mayor's daughter.
And was all this done in front of you?
All of it was done in front of me from a very young age. One of my safe places was the closet. I would spend a lot of time literally in the closet waiting for them to be done fighting. We lived in they used to do these houses where it would be the main house, and in the back there would be like a servant's quarter. Mm-hmm. That's where we lived, in that servant's quarter. We rented out. So it'd be like a one bedroom, not even apartment, mm-hmm. but pretty close to it. So we were in the one bedroom part, and then there was like a little kitchen, and the living room was like half the size of your office. So,
oh, wow. It was, that it's small.
It was a super tiny space. And that's where all three of us lived. And so my crib and their bed was separated by a foot that you could barely squeeze in. And then there was another foot between my crib and the closet that I'd hide in. Like, it was a very tight, small, small space. So it wasn't like I could run anywhere else to see this. And it wasn't until my mom got pregnant again with my little brother, and at this point I was about 7, that we moved. And we moved into a bigger apartment. And even that move was something that my mom was like, we have to move to a good neighborhood. We have to move into a good place because we're going to be here for a very long time. And so all of that time was just my parents constantly fighting with, yelling at each other, lots of beatings, crying, lots of just severe domestic violence where you just never know, is today going to be a good day or not?
Was that ever directed towards you?
No.
And at 7, how did you process this?
There's a couple different ways. I was going to say there were lots of ways that I processed it, but one of them that seems to be the one that sticks out more is I would escape mentally. And so that's kind of where my fandom obsessions started, because I needed an escape. And so I would, escape into my magazines or into, just following the different, at this point it was like boy bands that I really liked. But I also didn't know English when I went to kindergarten. Spanish was the only language I knew. That's what my parents knew. And so a lot of the times it felt like it was like I was aligned with my mother and it was us against my dad. That's what it felt like, because it was always the two of us. It was the two of us going to work together. It was the two of us, when you go home and there's those flyers on your door for the pizza place or whatever. Mm-hmm. My mom was doing that. That was the type of job that my dad would allow her to get. And she didn't have credentials here. She didn't have the language. She didn't have anything. So it was always the two of us. And you asked if that was ever directed at me. I was never involved in the fights, but I would sometimes try to intercede and be like, no, don't do that. Or I was used as a weapon of emotional manipulation, mm-hmm. where my dad would be like, get your mom to talk to me. And I would go and I would talk to my mom and be like, he's so sorry. Like, please forgive him, and do those things that as a little kid, you're thinking, okay, well, what can I do to try to fix things?
And that's where your family dynamic of you being the caretaker and the hero come in.
Probably.
And how, besides your role, I know your role and your dynamic within the family, what were the rest of the dynamics in the family and how did that impact you?
My dad was definitely stoned a lot. I distinctly remember that. My mom, I don't remember her at a young age drinking a lot. That was when I was older that I started to see that dynamic. But even then, I still felt very aligned with her in everything that was going on. And it was like, we're the good guys and my dad's the villain. That's the way it felt for a very long time. And we tried to get out. My mom went to a shelter, I think when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And I remember us going, but I also remember that somehow my grandmother found my mom at the shelter.
Grandmother on your mother's side or your father's side?
My father's side, because only his family.
Only his family came to the U.S.
Yeah. And so what they would do is, so he's got a younger brother, and he and my grandmother would basically come down to convince my mom to take my dad back and just to kind of get over it. And
that's the Hispanic way.
get over it. It's fine. And there would be periods of time where my dad would go live with my uncle because we'd kicked him out, mm-hmm. or things got really bad. And so even though my mom tried to escape, and this is what happens with a lot of domestic violence victims, they try, but it takes at least about 7 times for you to be able to break the cycle of abuse and get out. My parents are still together. There's no physical abuse. There hasn't been physical abuse in probably...
That you're aware of, correct?
I'm pretty sure I'd be aware of it. I'm pretty sure they'd tell me because of that role mm-hmm. that I have in the family. I would know. Now, has there been other fights with other family members? Yeah, that's part of why my brothers are estranged. Like, they've gotten into fights with my dad. I think my dad uses more self-control because he feels like he has 1 foot in the U.S. and 1 foot in Nicaragua because he's not a U.S. citizen. And calling the cops, okay, you know what? That affects your ability to get status. And so you've got this backdrop of my parents constantly fighting mm-hmm. and little things. And then there would be a buildup of, okay, is this going to be, you know, is this fight or is this comment the one that's going to cause you guys to go to blows? Mm-hmm. And am I going to have to be here for it? And then when once my little brother came along and once he started being interesting, as little kids do, right? Mm-hmm. Or once they started being aware of things, that's where I became super protective. I was like, no. I'm not letting your guys' crazy affect him. It did in a different way. And I ended up being like a second mom to him. Mm-hmm. So there was that chaos is the only word I can think of.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. And this was always going on. When I was in middle school was another time we left for a shelter and I got pulled out of school. I was out of school for a couple weeks. I had to go somewhere else. And we eventually went back to the house. And I remember my dad was so angry and I don't even remember what it was, but I was so terrified of him that we lived in this fourplex and we were in the bottom biggest unit that they had. They had 3 bedrooms and my parents' bedroom had a sliding glass door and we weren't letting my dad in. I was not letting him in. Like there was just, he was mad and I felt, this was the only time I felt he's going to attack me. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, finally my mom was like, go ahead and let him in. And I let him in, but he was already so mad and so upset that he came running through the house. And I just ran and I locked myself in the bathroom, the hallway bathroom. And I just locked in there. And I just remember him pounding and pounding on the door. He was just so fucking pissed off at me.
And, for not letting him in the house?
Yeah, for not letting him in the house. And I was just terrified. Like even just thinking about it, it's like I can feel my heart rate just kind of going up. Because it's one of those memories that sticks out. It's like, this is what was happening. And so what was I doing? I was doing anything else.
Absolutely. So I'm curious. What was your relationship towards your mom? I mean, I know you had talked about it was just like you and her against the world, essentially. But at some point, I mean, you've got a level head on your shoulders where you're like, wake the fuck up, mom.
I spent a lot of time probably in my teen years, in my early teen years, especially when I was starting to rebel, telling her to leave them. Mm-hmm. And then I had the guilt because when I was, 5, 6 years old, I'm telling her to stay with him. It's like, well, how am I supposed to know that this is a good thing or the bad thing to do? You're not going to know those things. And so I spent a lot of time trying to convince her, hey, leave my dad. We'll figure it out. Like, whatever it is, like, this isn't good. Like, one of these days he's going to kill you. Like, it's just, it's bad overall. And it just fell on deaf ears for a very long time. And so it's almost like, if you're not going to care about yourself, why should I care about anything? And so I was especially during my early teenage years, I was very suicidal. I was self-mutilation, not quite cutting, but I would like carve things into myself. Mm-hmm. And now as an adult, I realize what that was. It was like I was trying to find other ways to get attention, but nobody was paying attention to anything. The only time that my mom paid attention to me was I'd reached out to a friend. We'd have this really close family that knew all the stuff. They knew all the drama with my parents. They knew, like, very few people in our world knew what was going on. This family did. And it was my mom's best friend. But they decided to buy a house, and so they moved away. And they were no longer around. So I was writing letters with the oldest kid there, so the daughter. And I'd asked her about sex because the guy I was, you know, not even seeing, I can't even say seeing, was like, hey man, like, when are we going to fuck? And I was like, I don't know. Like, it was just, so I'd asked for advice, but by the time I got advice back, it was too late. And so what she ended up doing was betraying my trust and telling my mom. Mm. And so I get home one day and I'm walking home from middle school. And I walk into the house, and you know when you walk into a place and you can just feel the energy.
Oh yeah, it's palpable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I walked in. I walked in to you know, open up the door, and when you walked in, on the left hand side would be the kitchen, and it was the kitchen table. It was one of those round tables with the, like, I feel like they were everywhere at the time in the 90s. The wooden, like, kind of carved out flowers on the,
yes,
on the, yeah, like.
I'm sorry, you're telling the story. My heart is racing because I just know what's coming.
And my mom just, she's sitting there and she's kind of like, she's slumped over. She's in the seat and she's looking at, you know, she's just looking down, and I know that something's off. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't even like do an icebreaker or anything else. She just straight up looks at me and is like, have you had sex? And I don't lie. Mm-hmm. It's against one of my values. It is just, and I think part of it is because of my parents' chaos. I have a very hard time lying. And so I said yes, which she was not expecting at all. I wasn't going to lie. She asked a direct question. I answered it. And then at that point, it became about her. Everything that followed afterwards was because of
her. How could you do this to me?
How could you do this to me? I'm the worst mom. I'm a failure as a mom. Calling my grandmother in Central America and her sisters to like talk about it. And she talked to everybody else in the world about it except for me. I was given the cold shoulder for about like 3 months.
Wow.
And that was rough. That was really rough. And so it's like, in part of even my mentality about sex at the time was, what's going to happen eventually? What does it matter? Mm-hmm. And now I know, and this is a recent revelation that just came to me earlier this year, like that was a way for me to self-harm. It's just like, what? I don't care. I didn't care about it. I didn't care. You know, and even now I have a very different attitude towards sex and other things that may not go with the norm or the majority. Whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the norm is. But it's all of these things that really go back to that time period of just, okay, I know this is bad. And I think that for me was definitely a pivotal moment, because that alignment that I'd felt with my mom was broken. Mm. And has never been repaired.
So, I mean, it sounds like you didn't really have many people to turn to, and that you went inward. And in a previous episode, you talked about practicing narrative therapy, and that was something that you did in your younger years and then something that you did somewhat recently. And so do you believe that your creative or your artistic side was an outlet for you during this time?
No. I think that the reason I got into some of the arts, particularly music, was to try to find a connection with my dad. Mm. When that opportunity came up to be in the band, my dad never missed a concert, ever. And that was the only thing I could get him to go to. Everything else, I tried volleyball, I tried soccer, I tried basketball, and my parents couldn't do it because of both the timing of when it would happen, and it would be during like a dinner rush or other things where they needed to be working. But I also feel like they never tried to really do those things. I think my mom went to like one game, and mind you, it probably would have been a waste of their time anyways, because I'm not as athletic as I would have liked to have thought. Okay. Like, but music, yeah, they would always take the day off for music. My dad would always do that. More, I think my mom would go, but it wasn't her favorite thing. And even though I liked other things, like I liked acting and I liked doing those things, the message I got was, this is too time consuming for us, so you can't do it. Even though nobody directly told me that. And it was one of the things that I know Ron had mentioned when we were talking to him about, like, oh, you know, you've always been a performer. Yeah, I have been. And since I was a young age, like since I was a little kid, like that was one of the things, like there's pictures of me in my crib with headphones on, or like pretending to do that and like singing, right? Like mm-hmm. my idols were Mariah Carey and Paula Abdul. Like this music was always a big connection and outlet. But a big part of it had to do with that need for connection that I wasn't getting.
So you talk about this pivotal moment with your mom. At that point, do you just go ham on like the destructive behavior?
I just don't care. I don't care for a really long time. So you
just threw everything to the wind and you're like, fuck it.
I was like, fuck it. I'm going to do whatever I want. Nobody really cares about me. Nobody's really looking out for me. I'm going to look out for myself. And, you know, if I get pregnant, I'll take care of it. Like, I would leave school and go to Planned Parenthood and, you know, get birth control. Like, I never had an abortion, but I definitely had the mindset that, well, if that happens, cool, I can do that. Like, it was just so, I was so cavalier with myself mm-hmm. on how I thought about things. But at the same time, I had gotten this messaging as early as I can remember, in order for you not to be in my situation, you have to go to college. It's like, okay. So I was brainwashed into, you have to go to college. And so I always thought, well, I'll go to college. I didn't know what the fuck that meant.
Well, I was just about to ask you, so was there a moment? So you have this, you know, chaotic childhood. You have this pivotal moment with your mom and you're like, fuck it. And you're just engaging in, you know, destructive behavior, something we would consider, you know, destructive behavior. Was there a moment where you're like, what the fuck am I doing? And like, I need to, like, when you basically made the decision to change, what happened? What transpired that like made you like say, I need to wake the fuck up if I want to break this cycle?
I don't know that there was any one thing that happened. What I would say is more, there were little things that my ego really liked when I would perform really well, or when I would get accolades for doing something really good
in school.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would get certain things, like I got a presidential award for the most improved student that was like signed by the president in eighth grade or whatever. And it was like feather in my cap. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I liked those things. But I didn't like them enough to be consistent. And when you didn't get into a certain track, it straight into high school, it felt like to me that nobody else really cared about what you were doing. And so even though the teachers would be like, oh, you know, you're really good at writing, like I would like that. And then I would seek out more of that in order to get more of that validation, because I wasn't getting that anywhere. And so then there were a couple things that happened that, like, I was so inconsistent with school. I was really good at it when I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of the thing that would come back to. And so my senior year, I went through this breakup, and in that breakup, I basically threw myself into school, and it was the first time in my entire high school career that I'd gotten straight A's, and I got to do like the straight A luncheon and, you know, all these things that they do for students when they do really, really well. Like, it was my first time getting those accolades, and I enjoyed that. And I was like, damn, like if I'd discovered that sooner, maybe I would have done better in school. I don't know.
Did you have any support system at this time? Obviously, it doesn't sound like your family, but did you have like friends or close friends or?
I had a group of friends that we were good, and there was, I seem to, I'm somebody who draws a lot of people towards them. And people who have problems, I have problems too, but I've always been a really good listener. And so I feel like I was more of a support for other people than necessarily people supporting me. And when I removed myself from some of these groups by either throwing myself more into school or realizing, well, I'm not going to college. I have to go to a junior college first because I didn't do what I needed to do beforehand. I didn't know what I needed to do beforehand. It wasn't until I was in junior college that I finally had somebody in my corner. And that was my counselor, that he basically was like, you can do all these things. And he was the one that would challenge me when he'd be like, well, you know, why don't we get you into the honors program? I'm like, me? Honors? And he's just like, why not? Okay.
So really, it sounds like you were your own best motivator. So how did you encourage yourself to keep moving forward?
I knew what the end goal was. And that end goal for me was, you have to go to college. And then at some point, it became, you have to go to law school. You have to become a professional. That was always the end goal. And I can accomplish long-term goals. I'm pretty good at that. So it was myself along with being able to just figure it the fuck out. FITFO.
You live by your acronyms, don't you?
That's been a big one in my life, yeah.
And I'm always curious, like, I know that there's always these like little nuggets of wisdom like embedded deep within our past. So looking back at your upbringing, what are some good things that have come from it?
My appreciation for the arts definitely comes from my family, music in particular, and then I took it another step further with just my love of acting and theater and things like that. But that definitely comes from my dad.
And how has your childhood better prepared you for life?
Well, that's the funny thing, that even though I've had a pretty rough go at it at the beginning of life, all of those skills of being able to read a room, being able to have that high emotional intelligence of seeing somebody and knowing that they're in distress or knowing that something's off, just basically paying attention to other people, comes from trauma. Mm-hmm. And so I've now realized that a lot of the things that I went through, people are actively trying to become more aware of others or aware of how they affect others. And that stuff's really easy for me to do. I'm like, this is a power. This is a skill.
People pay for this.
Okay.
So I'm also kind of curious, too. How would you describe yourself then and how would you describe yourself now?
Then I would say, if I go back to like my 12-year-old self, I was very lonely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lonely is like the biggest thing that comes out. Even though I could be spirited and I could be around a ton of people, I always felt like I was alone. Mm-hmm. Now I'm very fortunate to have a great support system. But it's the family that I choose. And, you know, in the show that I'm obsessed with, Supernatural, one of the things they say is family donut with blood. And that's like a huge part of the fandom. And that's how I feel. It's like I have a family that is not my blood family. Mm-hmm. It is everybody else. It's you. It's Matt. It's Ron. It's these friends that I've, you know, collected over the years that we're still in contact with. Like, these are the people that make up my family. And then I have my actual blood family that I deal with or tolerate.
Tolerate is such a good word. And I thank you for sharing. And like our other interviews, I'd like to end it with our two signature questions.
Okay.
The first being, looking back, what would you tell your younger self?
You're not alone and it's going to be okay.
Simple yet powerful. Looking forward, what is one wish you have for yourself on this current journey?
Oh my God. I have so many wishes.
Then give me all the wishes.
Give you all the wishes. I think the main wish that I have is to continue to live authentically. I just want to continue to do that because I've spent so much time trying to be something else, trying to fit into a box that was not made for me. Mm-hmm. And my experiences are things that have made me who I am. And even though they've been rough, they're part of the whole package. And so I don't shy away from talking about these things. They've been hard to talk about. And, you know, especially the suicidal thoughts, because I felt like even if I tried, I don't think anybody, like nobody noticed. And like, that was the hardest part. So just owning my full self and being authentic all the time. Like that's what I'm, my number one wish for myself is to continue to do that and not let myself fall into some old programming of trying to please everybody else.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. And I can say that you are definitely living authentically. I think even in just the few years that I've known you, you've always stayed true to your core beliefs, and you've not been afraid to say no, and you live your truth. And I'm just so proud of you. So thank you.
Thank you. That's it for this episode. If you've been a victim of domestic violence or know someone who's a victim of domestic violence, you can reach out to 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 7233. Let us know your thoughts on this episode in our private Facebook group at Pivotal Moments HQ. As always, want to thank our producer and music director, Ron Johnson. This has been an Astronomicus DMR production. Thank you for listening. Remember, it's never too late, and you're right on time.